love by any name. Well, in the Valentine's week, a week that I didn't get to celebrate Valentine's Day because there was a board meeting of this church, Greater Love Hath No Man That He Sacrifices Valentine, for a board meeting. I want to talk about love, and I want to talk about love in a way that with any luck at all will not put you into insulin shock or ketosis, because there's always the chance of making it flowery and chocolatey and syrupy when love is not all romance and not all sentimentality. It's sometimes hard work that seems to be, as attorneys would say, adverse to interest. There's an irony and a bit of a paradox in talking about love in the first place, because it's a little bit like talking about dance or explaining flavors. What does that taste like? Well, it's a little bit like trying to explain colors to a blind person or a Bach cantata to a deaf person. Because love is something that is not about belief, it is about experience. And not simply passive experience, but the active experience of giving and sharing and exchanging. I'm turning around an old theological sermon that I've done and just looking at the other side, which is when people ask me, because I'm in the religion business, about my beliefs in divinity, I tell them belief is the wrong word. It's about experience. It's not about words and beliefs and theology and discussion groups. The same is true about love. No one ever asks me if I believe in love. It's a silly question at a lot of levels. Somebody may ask me before a wedding, do you believe in their love? But that's a different question. Believing in love is kind of silly. We experience it or we don't. We give it or we don't. We know it, or we're confused. Okay. Love is classically trifurcated into the three Greek categories of agape, phile, and eros. Agape being that divine love, the godly love, the parental love that accepts all. It's my experience that even that accepts all has some limits, particularly during the teen years. On both sides, incidentally, both from the teen and from the parent's point of view. The phile is kind of an intellectual love, stereotypically, and the eros is, well, I don't need to explain eros to you. You all got here somehow. But they are confusing. They're not discrete categories that we can keep easily apart. They are fuzzy, they are leaky membranes, and eros and phile and agape can all get mixed up, particularly in the moonlight with mood music, and people, well, sometimes tragic and sometimes happy consequences. Love can't be captured in our words. The poets have tried since the beginning of time. Novelists have worked on showing what love is. The Bible is filled with theological love and lustful love and male bonding kinds of love, which I'll get to in a little bit. Comics mock love, cynics and skeptics mock love, and society in some ways seems to be all in favor of romance, but not very nurturing of love, which is deeper and more difficult and more complex and, with any luck at all and with hard work, more lasting than romance. And we as a society confuse those things. Love is built into our evolutionary biology, but it is not really measurable. We can do skin galvanic impedance response measurements of people in love. We can do electroencephalograms of people who are feeling love or passion or lust. We can do all kinds of measurements, but they are different from the experience of giving and receiving. Love is deeply rooted in who we are and in our survival. Without love, no one would be here. And I'm not talking about the simple biological act of sex. You can obviously have sex without love, but the answer to the question, will you still need me, will you still feed me when I'm 64, would be no. Because something's got to transcend that moment of passion. That may be a beginning, that may be a middle, for too often that's an end, but it is not what love is in the deep and complex evolutionary sense of love. At the moment, because of the movie Brokeback Mountain, people are asking the question, can men love each other? My well-thought-out and reasoned theological answer to that is, well, duh. And I'm talking about eros, philae, and agape. For better or worse, despite the homophobia in most, in at least American military, every army depends on love. Every military force, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, from Baghdad to Bosnia, our armies march and operate on a concept of love. Greater love hath no man that he would lay down his life for his friend. That's the discipline that we try to create with the insight that human beings occasionally have that, you know, for a moment, I am not the most important creature in the universe. It may be my buddy in my squad. It may be my friend on my team. It may be my child. It may be my wife. It may be my parents or my grandparents. It may just be my friend. The idea that we are joined in some kind of bond where something is greater than our own immediate and our own immediate impulse is at the beating heart of what love is. It is about connection and sacrifice for something the self is attached to, but going beyond the self itself. Because without that, we are incredibly lonely, incredibly isolated in this skin sack of self, without the connections, whether physical or emotional, to the other. Yes, every army operates on it. The sports cliche is there is no I in team. An awful lot of egos in team, but there's no I in team because there is a sense of connection, of joint enterprise, of being connected in something that is greater. That's what we do with families. That's what we do with teams. On the downside of it, that's also what we do with mobs. As they surrender in the excitement, the self devolves and joins into that larger group, and it can create terrible things, but it is the kind of surrender and annihilation of self by joining that is the leitmotif connecting the various kinds of love, creating something greater than simply the self, being joined together. It is deep in our DNA, and it needs to be, because our children take an awful long time to mature. Some of our adults take an awful long time to mature also. we can look at all different kinds of bonding and family systems out there in the rest of the natural world and be very impressed. But, you know, the paramecia, after they've exchanged genetic information and split, you know, it's kind of the one-minute stand, that's about it. The new paramecia are just about as good as they're going to get, and the parents don't have anything more to contribute. Even those amazing, fantastic, wonderful penguins that knocked us all out with their dedication, their self-sacrifice, it's only for a year. And then they're out looking for somebody else to be dedicated to, well, actually some other penguin to be dedicated to, and they're telling their young, go jump in the water and go fish. And that's the job of the adult penguins, that's the job of the baby penguins. But our job lasts longer than simply birth and nursing and kindergarten. And if you read the LA Times on Friday, $25,000 a year at Marlboro for a private high school, if you can afford it, or feel deeply guilty if you can't and the kids don't get into the right university. But part of what love is that kind of sacrifice too. Hey, I want a giant screen plasma TV that'll fill up the room. I want the biggest TV I can get, and I want the smallest cell phone I can get that will also multitask and call up all my friends and keep a record of them and tell me what's for dinner on Wednesday night and when my theater tickets are. I want all of those things, but I have children with needs, and I have family with needs. And adverse, not to interest, but to impulse, we connect with something that is greater and more enduring. Romance, our society is all about romance and nurturing romance. But marriage is tougher than romance. I mean, I got a dog in this fight. I do weddings. I marry people, men and women, men and men, women and women. I cash the checks for marrying people, so I'm not a disinterested spectator in all this. And I believe in love, and I believe in romance, and I believe in the long-term work that takes to transition romance into love. Fortunately, I drink. This is a good thing. I drink wine, and so I have immediate experience, not intellectual experience, but really somatic experience of wine. And wine that can be absolutely wonderful in its youth, bright with bright flavors and fruit and intoxicating. And over time, a great red wine and even some great white wines change. They mature. They deepen. The great and real virtues of youth, of effervescence, change into something more complex, more interesting, deeper, more profound, and more moving. But they don't deepen by themselves. You leave it out in the sun, it's gone. Put it above the stove, it's history. Don't treat it right, and it will not mature. It will not grow. It will not deepen. So, too, with the loves in our lives. Mates, parents, children, grandchildren. They take time. Time to transition from the heady romance of first love, from a new birth and how cute a baby is, to the more difficult years, to living with and through the teen years and what passes for music. We make choices. We make choices to go for the young and the bright, or to work at the conditions that allow us to create and experience the joys of deepening relationships, the work that it takes to create the conditions where we can mature together, mature to the point where we don't hear everything and forgive much. And we can go from, that was awfully cute when we were dating, to that was awfully annoying in the fifth year, to that is how it is in the tenth. Love never means saying you're sorry. Well, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. It means saying I'm sorry when I don't really mean it, to tell you the truth. It also means not simply forgiving, but it means also not hearing. A selective listening and generosity of heart and of spirit with all. And I'm not simply talking about marriage and dating. I'm talking about family. I'm talking about church. I'm talking about political clubs and other ways that human beings come together with all of our sharp elbows and prickly parts. All the ways that human beings get choices about how we react when we bump into each other. And we will bump into each other. There is no love without friction. There is no intimacy, no family without arguing. There is never a sense in a real relationship that you don't want to slam a door and go marching out loudly and dramatically. That's when we lose our capacity to feel great things in terms of hurt and vulnerability and anger. We also lose our capacity to feel great things in terms of warmth, of nurturing, of loving, and of caring. One of the great rules of society is that you cannot make love while wearing armor. That the armor that protects us from the slings and arrows of outrageous family members also protects us from the touch and truth of intimacy. And we need intimacy. We need connections. We need to be together and not alone. A call from a kid, even if he's in Afghanistan. A call to a parent, even if that parent is difficult. A call to a friend, even if you've had a fight. One of the questions that I get most in my professional life, and I get most after a sermon, is, okay, what do we do? What do we do? The world's complex. The political issues are overwhelming. There are two sides to every question. What little difference can I make in this world? In this huge, complex world, what meaningful thing can I do in the world? And the answer is just so simple. There's nothing more important than we do than loving one another. You want something great and grand and grandiose? Start with taking off a little of the armor. Continue with opening up your heart and opening up your arms into an embrace of somebody that you love. Somebody that you want to love, somebody that you're mad at, somebody who will benefit from having arms around them and feeling the warmth of a human friend and the beating of a human heart. This is not a world that is too big for us to influence. The very most important thing we can do, it's the heart of every religion, is verily love one another. Well, okay, I am reminded by Judy of my mother-in-law's experiences of female bonding, which were very similar. My mother-in-law is a Holocaust survivor from the death camps and the work camps, and we went to see Schindler's List. And my mother-in-law is sitting next to me, and a fellow survivor named Fella is sitting next to her, and in the middle of Schindler's List, they're talking, and then they're giggling. And you can't really go, have you no respect for the Shoah, to survivors. So it was peculiar. So afterwards, I asked her about it, and I asked how, what was going on? And she said, well, you know, the movie was very good. Nothing like the reality, but the closest to the reality that she had seen, but a shadow of a shadow of a shadow of the reality. I said, but you were laughing. She said, we were remembering being girls. That when they were stuck in those racks on wooden pallets, we were remembering in the cold that we were all mushed together, and if Sucha turned over, then Sesha had to turn over, then Anja had to turn over, then Edja had to turn over, then Branya had to turn over, then Fermet had to turn over. They all turned as one. And then they all turned back as one. Three of them had consecutive numbers. When they came to this country, my wife doesn't know who her cousins are, because they're the people who had consecutive numbers, were family, and are still family. And that's female bonding. Did you all hear the question?
No.
Okay, so Barbara asked, there are cases where people talk about they loved somebody their entire lives, and that love was never returned. Is love not returned still love? And can you love somebody who doesn't return your love? When we ask the question in the romantic sense, it seems rather complex. When we ask it in the child sense and in the parent sense, it becomes a little more painful, but more self-evidently true. That there are abused children who love their entire lives and are looking to find out what they did wrong to cause the abuse. There are rejected parents who search all their lives with breaking hearts to try to figure out where the bond got broken. Can you love romantically and never have it returned? Can you love from afar? I think that probably is usually romance. And someone enjoys the pain, the wiggling the loose tooth of the sorrows of the young Werther, of the idea of love. But I'm not sure love has to be reciprocal or that it is ever an even playing field, because people have different languages of love and respond to different signs and different cues. I don't want to trivialize this, but it used to be when I was trained in the ministry that we're supposed to do all kinds of hours of premarital counseling with people, which I found to be of absolutely no value in predicting the longevity of their marriages. As some of you know, I performed two marriages that didn't survive the reception. That's maybe a lack of commitment. I don't know. You take, at least until the end of the cocktail hour. One didn't even make it to the cocktail hour. That's a long story that doesn't really belong right here at the moment. But I can't predict. A masochist and a sadist can have a very long and nourishing relationship together. And if you marry two masochists, they could make each other miserable. Well, never mind. But I think you get my meaning. We can't really understand the various ways that people attach, sometimes to people, but sometimes just to an idea. And when you're talking about unrequited love, I think it's usually to an idea of a person as opposed to the person, him or herself. You know, hate is toxic to the hater. And so there you have real wisdom in that, not simply as a strategy, I won't let him see it. But that's one part. But the other part is that when we hate, all of that epinephrine, all of those chemicals flood into us, and it's not good for us. When a story that is both true and factual. One of the two times I ever got spanked, I was bothering my father while he was doing his income tax. I was 8 years old. What did I know about the income tax? And he finally had had it, and he took me over his knee, and he said, "This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you." And he goes, whack, and I had a pocket knife in my pocket, which, not open, which he hit, and he went, ah! He said, "Oh, that did hurt me more than it hurt you." That's, Jim, that's exactly what I meant by this is a society that nurtures romance, but not the deepening bonds, not the sitting down to dinner. My very greatest regret in my life, and I mean, I could pick from a menu and with three you get egg roll, but my very greatest regret in my life was having the TV on too much at dinner time and not servicing and being together for the shared experiences enough or as much as it could be. As to what, however, parent, we don't know about our parents. I mean, we really don't know. There are people who fight, there are people who yell, and that's how they meet. That's their language. That's their language of love. It's not all moonlight and roses. I just keep thinking about Golda. Do you love me? Do I what? For 25 years, I fought with you, I lived with you. If that isn't love, we tend to think romance. But love, and I don't know if I used, I wrote the word in the manuscript, but I don't know if I used it, the phrase, love is radical tolerance. Yeah, I did. It's coming back. Love is radical tolerance of parent, child, spouse, friend, congregant.